Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on AmericaOutloud.com. This has been a very tragic week. A gunman, a Muslim who was radicalized, went to a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and committed the worst active shooter in American history. He took the lives of some 50 people and shot another 53. And he did so ahead of a cold, calculating heart. He did so in the name of his Muslim religion, a religion that's supposedly of peace. And yet, with darkness in his heart and in his mind, he committed mass savage murder in the name of Islam. There was some talk about the police response. The Orlando Police Department responded. Police officers who were actually on duty at the door of the club engaged this suspect in gunfire. Police officers then went into the club and exchanged gunfire with him in the club after he had shot so many people. And then the gunman ran into the bathroom area where he held hostages. And they attempted to negotiate with him for several hours and get those hostages out. When it became apparent that this was not going to end peacefully, they made a really dynamic decision of breaking through the walls of the bathroom with a Bearcat armored vehicle and rescuing the hostages, at which time the suspect came out, opened fire, striking a police officer in the helmet. If he had not had that helmet on, he would have killed that police officer as well. SWAT officers from Orlando PD and Orange County Sheriff's Department then took the suspect's life. This is tragic on so many different levels, but the police response was something to be proud of. In this week's episode, you're going to hear my interview with a retired New York City police detective named Randy Jurgensen. The reason that this is important and his story about the book that he has written is because there are correlations between what took place with another Muslim terrorist in 1972 as to what took place just this week. His story is amazing. It is sad. It is frightening. And it will leave you speechless at the leadership of the NYPD and the city of the New York City Police Department and the City of New York Mayor's Office. It will leave you with questions. It will leave you angry. I'm very proud that I was able to interview retired police detective Randy Jurgensen, and thank you for tuning in to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Let's take a walk over to the interview room where I have a very special guest waiting for me. Randy Jurgensen, who has a stellar career with the NYPD and has written an amazing book. Let me give you a little background about Randy, and then we're going to talk about his book and how it relates to what's going on today. He's a decorated veteran of the Korean War. He joined the NYPD when he was 20 years old, and among other highlights of his career, he arrested Lenny Bruce and broke what became known as the Bag Murders, later to become a movie called Cruising. He's earned an amazing 40 citations, medals, and of course numerous plaques. He's appeared in over 30 films and television shows. But he has also written a book, and that's what we're going to be talking about. It is an amazing book called The Circle of Six, the true story of New York's most notorious cop killer, and the cop who ripped everything to catch him. Randy, thank you so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
It's my pleasure. I would also, if you would allow me, a shout out to my brother's family, which lives in Las Vegas, Arlene, and their three beautiful daughters and a number of grandchildren.
Okay, well, that's very nice because you know I'm in Vegas, and that's where they live too. Great.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about your book, The Circle of Six. This is, I couldn't put it down, and it's about a, well, you know what? I'm going to let you tell the audience what it's about, and then we'll talk about it in depth and how it relates to what's going on today.
Sure. Well, this book, which was published in 2009, I believe, and the paperback came out 3 years later. The book is a hardcover, Circle of Six, and it is has been judged an alternate bestseller. The paperback is going into its second printing. So, in terms of this book doing what it is doing, the odds basically were against this book for the following reasons. First of all, it's the story of a police officer who lost his life back in 1972. So you can see that's 44 years ago. So that story basically is ancient history. Also, it's a book written by myself and the co-writer Rob Say, and I'm a first time author, so the company literally took a chance on the book. And as it turned out, it was a good chance to take because the book has enjoyed a great readership.
Let's get down to the meat of the book. Now, this is about the death of a New York City police officer that took place in a mosque in New York
Correct.
City.
Yes. Well.
And the events surrounding this are absolutely shocking. Let's go into his killing and your position at the time and the role that you played.
Okay. I in 1972, when this took place, April of 1972, I was a second grade detective. I was considered a veteran. I had worked in Harlem. Of my 10 years, 11 years on the job, I had worked 9 years in Harlem. At this time in New York City, what we were experiencing, we would enter into an era of where there were 2,000 homicides a year, robberies, rapes, you name it, mainly 2,000 homicides a year. In the middle of all of that, there was a group called the Black Liberation Army, and the Black Liberation Army was executing cops, purposely setting them up and executing the police officers. They would kill from 1971 to 1972, they would kill 13 New York City police officers.
Wow.
In the middle of that, one day, April 14, 1972, I was on a stakeout, and I was looking for one of the cop killers. In fact, he'd become the number one, not suspect, the number one perpetrator on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. It was about 12 noon, and I was sitting down on a stakeout, myself and four others in my team awaiting this killer. When a 1013, which is a cop in trouble, call came over the air. And now a 1013 at that time, given what was going on, it was heightened, if you know what I mean. So we broke the stakeout, and I responded. And what I responded to was Minister Louis Farrakhan's Mosque Number 7. This was a militant mosque at the time. They had a group in there called the FOI, which is the Fruit of Islam Soldiers. Now, it seems that a call came out that there was a cop in that mosque, and that cop was in trouble. That's what prompted the 1013 call. Well, the radio cars began to respond to that location. I responded to that location. The first two cars that got to the, that got there walked in to the mosque. Four cops, four uniformed cops walked into the mosque. Now, I had been working, as I say, for 10 years in that area. I never once saw those doors unlocked and unguarded. At this time, these four police officers walked into this mosque. The doors were open and unguarded. As soon as they got in there, the doors were closed behind them, and the melee started. Now, these police officers took some beating. There were multiple ribs cracked and fractured. All of them suffered a concussion, loss of teeth. One would lose 30% the sight in one of his eyes. One ankle was broken. This was the severity of the beating that took place inside of the mosque. And of course, two of them, guns were taken. And one of the guns that was taken was used on patrolman Phil Cardillo, and they shot him. Now, by the time we got there and we could break in, literally break in and fire some shots through the window to get these police officers, to get these assailants, they had all run to the basement, and there were 14 or 15 of them lined up against the basement. Well, the first priority was to get these uniformed cops to the hospital, which we did. The cop that was shot, it didn't look that serious. Although you're shot, it's serious enough. So I came back to the mosque. And when I came back to the mosque, I mean, this was not the first dance that we had attended to. This was not the first cop shooting. When I left, the mosque was surrounded by cops. The crime scene was secure. And there were 14 prisoners downstairs up against the wall. Well, when I came back, there were no cops outside of the mosque. The crime scene was being trampled upon. And the prisoners downstairs were now seating in chairs. And Minister Louis Farrakhan was demanding their immediate release. And Congressman Charles Rangel showed up, and Congressman Charles Rangel ordered the police department out of the mosque, along with Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. A congressman ordered the police department to leave an active crime scene?
Yes. Not only that, but to leave without the 14, and if he wanted to call them suspects, assailants, we called them prisoners because the uniform cops were arresting them downstairs and trying to get their names. And I could go on with this, but the bottom line is that upstairs, out in the street, where there were now 400 to 500 people snake dancing, overturning cars, fire coming from some of the stores, two of the cars, one of them, my police car, was set on fire. And upstairs, an inspector ordered the white cops to leave the area. Unheard of. White cops leave the area and just leave 12 black cops to control this. In the meantime, downstairs, they were calling for help to try to remove the prisoners out because the mosque was now swollen with these FOI soldiers, and they began to threaten the seven or eight cops that were downstairs with the prisoners.
Let me stop you here for a second.
Sure, go right ahead. Sure.
Now, with any major crime scene like that, especially with four police officers being severely injured, that would normally be taped off as a crime scene, and you would have your crime scene technicians on the scene photographing and fingerprinting the evidence.
You're exactly right.
Did that happen?
No, no, that did not
happen.
Why
not? Why didn't it happen?
First of all, as I say, the Muslims now surrounded the mosque and they wouldn't let anybody in. And the ones that were downstairs couldn't get out with the prisoners. And upstairs, they had sent all of the white cops away, so there were just 12 cops against, I'd say, 500, 550 people. Downstairs, there were 7 cops against at least 50 FOI Fruit of the Islam soldiers that were closing in on the cops, plus the prisoners that were all up against the wall.
Well, nobody would have left that area had there not been a direct order given by someone very, very high
correct.
In the command structure of the NYPD.
Correct. Correct.
Who was that person?
And that man that gave that order was a commissioner, and his name was Benjamin Ward. And many years later, Benjamin Ward would wind up being the police commissioner of the New York City Police Department. So the deal, the so-called deal, was struck with Congressman Rangel that if we now leave the mosque, will you guarantee that these 14 prisoners will be brought into the precinct? And he said yes. Well, they left the mosque. They, too, got injured leaving the mosque. And
the
streets were in
total.
Oh, yeah. They were, and the streets were in total chaos. I mean, it was a riot. It was a riot down there. The smoke and the fire we had helicopters coming in and absolutely no reinforcements. They being the New York City Police Department, would not allow reinforcements to come into the area. So at the precinct, you know, the prisoners never showed up. I myself, and this is not about me, I myself sustained quite a serious injury myself. So I went to the hospital. You know, I didn't know that the prisoners didn't show up to the precinct, and I was on the same floor as the cop, Patrolman Phil Cardillo, who would 5 days later die.
The injuries that these four officers initially had when they were basically lured into a trap, the doors were closed, they were set upon by 14 to 16 suspects who beat them badly and then shot one of the police officers. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the NYPD administration basically
folded its tent and went home. And while the cop was in the hospital with his family, and while I was in the hospital along with the other three cops who were on the floor below, our police commissioner, Murphy, through the New York Times and through a local television channel, which I believe was Fox at the time, Channel 5, he came out and publicly apologized for our behavior entering a house of worship.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Almost word for word, I am, I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost word for word. While the cop was dying, this is what his family would hear. Now, Randy, the police officer passed away. Now, in 1972...
Wait a minute. Before we go on with this, the name of your book is The Circle of Six. Explain why it's called The Circle of Six.
Prior to my book, there were three other books that were written about this. Two only used a chapter about this. There were other ones in there. There was another one that devoted the full book to this. And all of those books, they say, they separated the white and black cops. They ordered the cops out of the mosque. They didn't bring the prisoners over to the precinct. I wasn't going to write a book like that. That's why it took me over 3 years. Freedom of Information Act, all kinds of movements that I had to make to find out, you know, who they were. And, of course, they were the mayor of the city of New York, who was Lindsay at the time. It was the police commissioner, Murphy, at the time. It was Congressman Rangel. It was Chief Ben Ward. It was Minister Louis of Farrakhan. Those are the six. Those are the six that played the roles that they played on that particular day and continued after that. And so I call them the Circle of Six. That's how the book got its name. This book, if you read it, it gives the name as to who ordered you out of the mosque. It gives the name as to who separated the black and white cops. That's the difference between my book and the other books that were written. And by the way, the book passed legal. The book passed legal. There's never been any lawsuit. There's never been, you know, any challenge to what is in that book as to what these six people, what they did that day.
Well, okay, and let's take this. Now let's go into the next area of this. And how did, and you were investigated in homicides as well, correct?
Yes.
Were you one of the investigators assigned to this case?
No.
You saw that this was not being investigated properly?
No. This case was assigned to a number of detectives who, for whatever reasons, they left the case. They didn't want the case. I mean, whatever their reasons were, and that went on for basically a year. Now, after the Black Liberation Army, which I and others chased them into Atlanta, chased them into Chicago, even San Francisco. I went and brought back prisoners, Black Liberation Army. That took me a year, and the word within the police department was on the year's anniversary, the police department in the city of New York was going to go on strike. And suddenly one day, and don't forget, I know every one of these police officers. I worked there for 10 years with them, maybe more. So one day I got called down to police headquarters, and they said, you're getting this case. You're getting the Cardillo case. It was 1 year. Well, it was a month short of a year. And then I got the case. And when I got the case, I got it with such restrictions, I knew I was never going to solve the case. And not being a hero or a wise guy, you know, they accused me of going rogue and going off the reservation. And I just literally did whatever I needed to do to bring about some resolution into this case. It took me 4 years. It took me 4 years to do that. But I was able to accomplish that, not by myself, with a lot of help from detectives that didn't want to be named, and a great deal of help from a friend of over 40 years, Joe Pistone, better known as Donnie Brasco. And you know, without his help from the FBI, I would have never been able to put this case together.
How did this case resolve?
Well, I had a grocery store list of charges now lodged against me,
and against you.
Yes,
and
disobedience, conduct unbecoming a police officer, disobeying orders. Seven of them, seven serious ones. I used a police sign to park my car at fingerprint places, this, that, and everything else. And I wasn't authorized to do that, so it was like an unlawful use of, that's how petty they, unlawful use of a police plaque in my car.
So wait a minute. So what you're saying is, because of your tenuous investigation, there were people in the upper ranks of the NYPD that were trying to stop your investigation and hinder it.
You see what happened here? What happened here is, when I got the case, I was not the least bit interested, and I want to repeat that, I was not the least bit interested who separated the cops. I was not the least bit interested that the mayor didn't attend the funeral. He didn't attend the funeral. He broke a tradition of over 100 years of all mayors attending, and the police commissioner didn't attend the funeral. I wasn't interested in this, cops. And the cops were, and I hope I can say this on the radio, the cops were pissed off at me because the cops were after them. They circled the wagons and were protecting themselves. I, as a lone wolf, I was asked after one person, the person that pulled the trigger. I mean, the mayor didn't kill the cop. The police commissioner didn't do it. I mean, so I wasn't interested in that. Right. And that's what the cops were very much interested in. That's who they wanted. I wanted the guy that pulled the trigger. And the only way I was going to do that was to basically almost leave the police department, which I'm not going to say that I did, but I set up an office outside of the police department, and I conducted my investigation. I just did it. I didn't tell anybody. And those are the charges that they got me for. The six of them, believed that I was investigating them. I was not. Maybe the cops were, but I wasn't investigating them. So they circled the wagon, and you know, and they lashed out at me. So that's really how that came about with all those charges. Now, as I knew that my charges were now pending, and I could not arrest the shooter. I couldn't arrest him. I was working in the DA's office. The police department said they make the arrest, and they were reviewing everything. And I knew that if I went to trial, that if they took me to trial, I was not going to get this guy. So I found a way through a detective who's mentioned in the book, that he was able to get the shooter to come down to court on a false charge. And when the shooter came down to court on the false charge, I went into the DA's safe, I took out the dead cop's handcuffs, and I went up into the court, and I locked them up for the murder of police officer Phil Cardillo.
Wow.
I was able to bring Phil Cardillo's partner there to witness the arrest. That's in the book. And as soon as I did that, they then took me and they put me on trial for all of those charges, the charges that I explained to you. In the meantime, we went to trial twice with the shooter. The first time was 10 to 2 for a conviction. The second time, he was acquitted. Remember, an acquittal doesn't mean that he's innocent. An acquittal means it. And why? Because we had no crime scene. We had no photographs. We had no fingerprints. We had no recovered bullets. I spent months proving with the help of the medical examiner that it wasn't friendly fire that did it. I mean, it was a tremendous uphill investigation, you know, before I could get to the real investigation. So that's what he was found not guilty. He was found not guilty.
What happened to him?
Oh, he's around.
He's still out and about.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened
so
to you?
So Minister Louis Farrakhan and Congressman Rangel, oh yeah, the rest of them. Yep. So I then went to trial and I pleaded contender.
Hold on a second. When you say you went to trial, this was a departmental.
Yes, a departmental trial.
Right. Based on rules and regulations.
They were charging me with a fingerprint crime. They were going to give me the perp walk. The fingerprint crime was the illegal use of the. An official police department sign that I used in my car.
That's absurd.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened as a result of those charges?
Well, the deal was that they would take 30 days' pay from me. They would break me from first grade detective to second grade detective, and that I would have to leave the job immediately after taking 30 days of vacation, which I had accumulated. And that 30 days vacation, and this is the truth, you know, left me 19 days short of having 20 years. And when my lawyer said, well, can he come back and do the 19 so that he can have, you know, he'll be going out, you know, on half pay or whatever it was in his pension, they said no. And so I went out 19 days short of having 20 years in the police department, 30 days pay taking, and a reduction in rank, and a reduction
and all,
in rank.
And all because you wanted to solve the crime of the murder of a fellow police officer.
Yes, yes. That's the truth, you know. And, you know, if you read the book, you know, along the way, I mean, I gave them ammunition, if you know what I mean. I really gave them ammunition to use against me.
You broke the rules in order to try and do the right thing. In movies, we applaud police officers that do that, don't we?
Well, the bottom line was that they gave me the highest medal, you know, for this, and I, through the newspapers, I officially turned it down, and boy, did that have an explosion. I said, nope, I'm not accepting anything from you guys. I won't take the right time from you guys.
I understand. No, now let me ask you this. You're still in the New York area, correct?
Yes, I am.
You have watched, I mean, so you went through a very historical time when the political pressures against police were at an all-time high, when the dangers facing law enforcement from black extremist groups like the Black Liberation Army were at an all-time high.
Absolutely.
When politicians who catered to the political left basically threw the police to the wolves. Are you seeing anything in today's environment that brings that back to you?
What I see today is that you have like the city councils that vote on these things, the local community boards that have a say-so. And I don't say that this is wrong, but what they are bringing about, what they are asking of the police officer out on the street, here's my example. Look, there are three kind of feasance, if you will. You know, there's misfeasance. That's if you do your job and you do it entirely wrong. There's malfeasance, and we all know what that is. You know, that, you know, you use your fist, your club, that's malfeasance. And then there's the one that's called nonfeasance. And the best example of nonfeasance would be, you know, there's a woman standing on the corner, and the woman and they're taking her purse, and you're standing over on this corner and you're not doing anything. Well, the way that they're asking the police officer to operate today with the guidelines that they're giving him, honest to God, you know, he can't do the job. He cannot do the job.
Right.
Stop and frisk has gone away. You know, you have to say to the person, can I do this? Am I allowed to do this? I am not saying that any of this is wrong. But what you take away is that instinct from that cop. What you take away is that gut feeling that something is not exactly right here. You take that away. And to boot, if you do something, you'll wind up in a lawsuit. You'll wind up, you're being investigated by various different agencies. If you can't do the job without getting in some kind of a problem.
Right. That's
politics.
Exactly. Now, here's where I want to ask you a very specific question. Do you see a correlation between the deterioration of the way the laws are being enforced in New York today as it related to when you were on the job and the same type of situations were taking place politically?
Politically, yes. A big yes. However, thank God, there are not groups. There have been individuals, but they're really not groups out there dedicated to the killing of police officers. We don't see that.
The same organized fashion as the Black Liberation Army was involved in the 70s as an active group of terror.
Exactly. And that's what they were. They were terrorists. I mean, they used bombs. They bombed police headquarters. They fired a rocket across the East River at one of the precincts. I mean, if that's not terrorism, I don't know what is.
Well, when you see like the other night, a state police headquarters station in Tennessee took a number of semi-automatic rounds into the building. When you see what took place in Baltimore with the streets being set afire and the police being basically told to stand down, do you see a correlation between what took place when you and your fellow officers were ordered to stand down during the investigation of the murder of a police officer to what's taking place today?
Well, I truly believe that we were, and I'll use that word to stand down. I believe that took place because of the place, and the place being a mosque, and the individual being Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, 1972, probably half or three quarters of your audience they weren't born even then. But in 1972, let me tell you, the Muslims, from Chicago, there was a bit of a war. Malcolm X was shot and killed. Muhammad Ali, may he rest in peace, was brought into Mosque Number 7, the very mosque that we're talking about, and changed his name from Cassius Clay. Yes, in 1972, had that not taken place, possibly, in a mosque, and Minister Louis Farrakhan and the names that I just gave you, maybe we wouldn't have been ordered to stand down. And that probably was the first of the beginning of what has actually gone right on up into today. It's gone right up into today.
Exactly. We're running out of time, Randy.
Sure.
But where can people get your book, The Circle of Six?
Well, the best way is Barnes & Noble carries it contractually. They have to. But Amazon.com. Amazon.com, I believe you can get the paperback. I believe it's $10 or $10.95, and the delivery is quite quick.
Very good. Now, do you have a website where people can read about you?
Yes, I do. And my website is www.RandyJurgensen, one word, RandyJurgensen.com.
I can't thank you enough for being a guest on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement today. You've experienced something that is so dramatic that I think that most police officers that are working today will hear about this and realize that the challenges that are facing law enforcement today may not even be the same as they were back then.
I couldn't be a police officer today. I could not. I love and respect these guys. I couldn't do it. Let me close with you that I think it was 4 years ago. I appeared out in Las Vegas at an international police association where these police officers came from Scotland, Ireland, Italy, Germany, Portugal, but going the other way, Hawaii and stuff like that. And I spoke out there for about a half hour, and they bought 400 books, and those books were carried back to all of those countries. And I hear from those police officers, not every one of them, but I hear from those police officers from those various countries regarding the book. So the book has gone outside of the United States, if you will.
That's awesome. I'm glad to hear of the success of this book. It's an important story, and it's really a very, very well-written book. Thanks again for being a guest on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
And it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Please take care.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
In this segment of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, one of the highlights that I believe this radio program has is called Police Story. And this is where I read the story written by an active duty, retired, or former police officer about something that occurred to them on the job that affected their lives. Today's story comes from a police officer from Springfield, Missouri. He started as a cadet and spent most of his career with the Springfield metro area. He was in Ozark, Missouri. He was with the Greene County, Missouri Sheriff's Department, Springfield metro area. He served about 15 years full-time, and then a few years as a reserve, and he is suffering from this career-ending affliction of PTSD. After you hear this story, you'll understand a little bit more about PTSD and the cause and effect that it has on police officers' careers. You can check him out at layersofblue.blogspot.com. I'm going to read this. It's called Children and the Devil. When I was a child, I grew up with poverty, neglect, physical and emotional abuse. I watched my mother get beaten and use drugs. I've been tied up, beaten with an extension cord, locked in closets, and much worse. As a police officer, I revisited my childhood several times a month, meaning I responded to domestic violence calls, child abuse, neglect calls, and dealt with children that had the same shell-shocked look I had. I'm not sure if most of you know what I'm talking about, so let me explain further. I'm looking at my own fourth grade school picture, and you'll see that my skin is pale and colorless, caused by poor nutrition and oftentimes hunger. There are bags under my eyes and dark circles caused by the anxiety of another violent night at home, not being able to sleep because of fear. My eyes are deep set and look lifeless. There is absolutely no look of emotion about my face, and the only way you know that I'm alive is because I'm standing. My clothing is wrinkled, obviously a hand-me-down, worn and dirty. My hair is unkempt, and it is apparent I haven't had a haircut in a long time. Weekly as a cop, I saw children just like this, and always had a soft spot for them, and a rough spot for the adult that put them in this situation. Today I'm going to share but one of my many stories about child abuse from my time on the streets. My district at the time was made up of mostly poor and lower class wage families. Most received assistance from the state for food and shelter. Many of these families were good and decent, with some type of circumstance contributing to their misfortune. But I'm sad to say that at least an equal percentage were the result of alcohol abuse and drug addiction, and more often than not, both. Drugs take a financial toll on a family. Addicts will sell their food stamps at a reduced rate, 50 cents on the dollar is common, so they will have money to get what they need. Presents children were given by relatives are often returned by the drug-addicted parent to, let's say, Walmart, and without a receipt, they received a gift card with a credit on it. Like the food stamps, they sell the gift card for a reduced rate to purchase narcotics. I was working day shift when an assault in progress call came in on my district. Man beating a woman in the yard. After arriving, I am greeted by a battered female with obvious injuries, intoxicated and staggering around in the yard. The male half is a fat white male without a shirt on, multiple tattoos, and covered in dirt and the like. He's obviously intoxicated and is yelling and cursing. My backup goes to the female half and I go to the male half. It's already obvious to me who the aggressor is and that the male half is going to jail, but we go through the motions of asking the sordid details. The female is yelling, "That fat motherfucker smoked all my pot." He becomes aggressive again, tries to shove past me to go after her. I get him in an arm bar and take him to the ground. He won't give me his hands and I apply a burst of pepper spray to his face. He still really isn't cooperating, but he's no longer aggressive and I get him in cuffs. As I'm loading him into the back seat of my patrol car, I see two little faces looking out of the front door. A little girl of about 5 and a little boy of about 3. Both in dirty clothes and filthy themselves, with the little boy wearing a diaper only that obviously needs to be changed. They're watching all of this. For a moment, I have one of my personal flashbacks of my childhood when I see their empty eyes. The other officer has arranged for a sober friend of the victim to be en route to the scene to take charge of the children. I go through my typical spiel about the uncooperative victim, telling her that we can take her and the child to a safe house and how to apply for a restraining order against the male. I also go through my spiel about children are fragile and like sponges, and they are going to take emotional cues from her, and she needs to calm down and act decent so the children's fear and anxiety will be reduced. And then the call is complete. 2 weeks later, I'm dispatched to the same residence for the same type of call. Only this time, the woman had thrown an electric frying pan with hot grease in it on the male half. Her nose is bleeding, and we can't determine an aggressor, so I arrest both. Of course, the male half was taken to the hospital first. Both were high and drunk again. Sadly enough, the children witnessed this too. The little girl's crying, just sobbing and yelling for me not to arrest her mommy. I took the children inside while other officers made the arrest. I waited with them while the grandparents, a jurisdiction about 50 miles away, were en route to take them. While in their home, I had the overwhelming smell of dirt, stale tobacco, and sweat. I had not seen a home this dirty since I was a child. All of the dishes were dirty and none were in the sink. There was mold growing on some of them and there were live maggots on others. Needless to say, there were flies and cockroaches that ran free range by the thousands. Not one thing in this home was where it should be, and everything was dirty and on the floor. I looked through the fridge and found there only to be Milwaukee's best beer and a tub of butter in the fridge. The cupboard was bare as expected. I asked the little girl what they had for breakfast, and she said her mom's boyfriend had picked some green apples off of the neighbor's tree and they had them, but they were sour. The little girl and boy shared a bedroom, and there were at least 50 dirty diapers on the floor. I couldn't take it anymore. I had dispatch call the responding party and have them pick up the kids at the police department, and with that, loaded the kids up into my patrol car and left that shithole of a house. I stopped at a Dollar General store and bought them both a pair of clean shorts and t-shirts and underwear and diapers. I also went through McDonald's on the way and ordered them some food. And after returning back to the PD, set them up in front of a TV playing the Disney Channel. A dispatcher helped me clean them up and change the boy's diaper. After the grandparents arrived and picked them up, I called the hotline for the Division of Family Services and reported the living conditions that the children were exposed to, suggested the children be taken from the home. Needless to say, I was devastated. The following day, I saw the mother's boyfriend walking down 3rd Avenue. Feeling furious, I stopped my patrol car and unofficially told him to get the fuck out of the kids' lives while suggesting bad things will befall him if he didn't. He apparently didn't get the message because I was called to the house the next day for another drunken, drug-induced fight where this piece of shit had broken the victim's jaw. I was sad to hear also that Division of Family Services had come and gone without taking action. other than a promise of a return visit in 14 days. I took the kids into emergency custody this time. As a police officer, I could legally do it. But within 24 hours, the Division of Family Services had returned them again. It was my day off, and I got a page from the police department with 911 at the end. I hurriedly found a payphone and called in. I was transferred to one of the detectives who wanted to tell me there had been another incident with the kids I was so worried about. Medical had been called to the home for an unresponsive child. When paramedics arrived, they found the little girl unconscious and bleeding from her ear and rectum. Only the boyfriend had been home. He claimed that he'd been playing with his child, wrestling and the like, and she had fallen off the kitchen table. At the hospital, doctors determined she had been sodomized anally with an unknown object that had caused tearing and bleeding to her lower intestine. The bleeding from the ear was consistent with an open hand strike to the ear. The ear that was damaged was the girl's right ear, which is consistent with a strike from a left-handed person. The piece of shit was left-handed. He'd been arrested at the crime scene, and the little boy had been taken into protective custody again. After several days, the little girl was, quote, out of the woods, unquote, and expected to make a full recovery. I visited her in the hospital several times. She was quiet and withdrawn. With the help of a therapist and a juvenile officer, I tried to gently question her about the incident, but she was too traumatized to answer, but would only say she fell. And while answering, she would look at the floor and recoil into nearly a fetal position. In some of the training I had received on interrogating and interviewing, they say this is the response to someone that doesn't want to answer truthfully and uses their body as a subconscious block. I assume this was the same with victims, too. The piece of shit had been released from jail after the mandatory 20-hour hold, as the prosecutor said there were no adult witnesses to the crime. No physical evidence, tons of evidence, just a shitty prosecutor, and the victim was too withdrawn to have enough to get an arrest warrant. Again on my day off, I was paged by the PD. When I called in this time, they asked me to come in, but wouldn't tell me why. 10 minutes later, the chief of detectives took me into his office, told me that the little girl had developed a staph infection and passed away. It was like lightning that struck me. I was floored. I began to sob uncontrollably, and I punched a few holes in the drywall. I was sad and furious at the same time. A couple of the other officers were in the office, and they were upset and crying as well, as we had dealt with this family so many times. The detective also told me that the prosecutor said that since her staff had killed her, that there would not be a charge of murder or even manslaughter, but they were, quote, following up leads on the Class D charge of child abuse. 10 minutes after leaving the police department, me and another off-duty officer and I went to the piece of shit's house. We didn't knock. We didn't ring the doorbell. We went through the open door, went straight to the living room where he was, and I began to beat him. His bitch of a girlfriend called 911, I guess as soon as we came in. I wanted to kill this son of a bitch. We roughed him up, and then we left. Knowing we were in trouble, we went straight back to the PD. The piece of shit was taken by ambulance to the hospital, but other than a few cuts and bruises, he would survive. An internal investigation was launched, and a couple of weeks later, we found out our fate. I was afraid that not only would we get fired, but we may be prosecuted. But I really didn't care. I thought it was worth it. The chief yelled at us for about 15 minutes. The prosecutor yelled for another 5 minutes, but no charges were going to be filed. The other officer was suspended without pay for 1 day. I was suspended without pay for 3 days. Matter closed. After everyone left, the chief called me back to the office and closed the door. He told me that I knew his official position, but wanted me to know his private position. He said he was proud of me, and when he was a younger officer, had done something similar. Just remember that the devil doesn't always wear his horns, carry a pitchfork, and have a bifurcated tail. Sometimes he's a shirtless, fat piece of shit drinking a beer. If you are a retired or active duty police officer, former police officer, and you are a writer or have a story that you have written and would like to share it with others, send it to me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Danger!
End of watch.
As always on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those who have given their lives in the line of duty by announcing their end of watch. This week, Police Officer Andy Ekpanya of the Pearland Police Department in Texas died in the line of duty on June 12, 2016. He was 30 years old. He only had 1 year of service, and his cause of death was vehicular assault. Police Officer Andy Ekpanya was killed when his patrol car was struck head-on by a drunk driver at the intersection of Broadway and Country Club Drive while he was responding to a non-emergency call. He was traveling eastbound when a vehicle traveling westbound crossed over the dividing line and struck his patrol car head-on. He was transported to the Memorial Hermann Hospital, but he died of his injuries. The driver of the other vehicle was charged with intoxicated manslaughter. The officer had only served with the police department for 1 year, and he survived by his 2-year-old son and his fiancée. Rest in peace. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, on the America Out Loud Network. This is Randy Sutton. You can catch me on Facebook under Randy Sutton, public figure. I welcome your comments and your questions. And check out my website, randylsutton.com, where you'll find all of my books, some of my music, and my videos from when I was on the TV show Cops, if you are so inclined. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.